Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week we begin our special two-part series marking the third anniversary of 9/11. We'll be focusing on a collection of essays originally published in the Journal of American History and then republished in 2003 by Temple University Press. One reviewer called it a splendid collection of essays that helps us make sense of the background and the aftermath of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. And that's what we hope to accomplish as well in this special series. Given the special nature of this show, we'll not be hearing from Dan Roberts with his moment in time. 9/11, after all, is our moment in time. But we'll take our customary look at history in the news, in this case reporting on news that relates to 9/11. Focusing on the Middle East, documents only recently made public suggest that the Eisenhower administration was prepared to use force to seize control of Middle East oil fields in the late 1950s. The policy, adopted by the National Security Council and approved by Dwight Eisenhower in 1958, came in response to mounting concerns about Arab nationalists gaining control of the region's oil supplies. The documents, located in the Eisenhower Library in Abilene, Kansas, state that the United States, in cooperation with the United Kingdom and other allies, should be, quote, prepared for the use of force as a last resort. As one U.S. official put it, oil was as important to the country's mutual security as atomic weapons. 50 years ago this year, the nation experienced another act of terrorism, this time in the U.S. Capitol, when four Puerto Rican nationalists opened fire from the visitors' gallery on the floor of the House of Representatives. They sprayed about 30 shots around the hall and wounded five lawmakers, one seriously. No one was killed, even though about 240 members were on the floor at the time. The shooting stunned the nation, but it was not the first such violent act on Capitol Hill. In 1835, President Andrew Jackson narrowly escaped an assassin outside the Capitol Rotunda. In 1915, a Harvard professor protesting U.S. policy toward Germany destroyed two Senate rooms with a bomb. And in 1971, a Vietnam War protester set off a bomb in a Senate restroom. The first metal detectors at the Capitol did not appear until 1976, and it was not until 1998 when a man with a history of mental illness shot and killed two Capitol police officers that the need to deal with security threats took on a real sense of urgency. And then came September 11th, 2001. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Talking History. Attacks of September 11, 2001, the Organization of American Historians called upon some of the nation's leading scholars to provide some historical perspective on an event that we all struggled to understand. The result was a landmark collection of essays that, as one reviewer put it, rejected the simplistic notion of an age-old clash of civilizations in favor of examining the histories of American nationalism, anti-Americanism, U.S. foreign policy, and Islamic fundamentalism. On this third anniversary of 9/11, for this first in our two-part series on the event, Talking History's Fred Nielsen interviews two of the authors included in that collection, Joanne Meyerowitz and Melanie McAllister.
My guest, Joanne Meyerowitz, is a professor of history and American studies at Yale University and the editor of History and September 11th, a collection of essays on the background and aftermath of the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Professor Meyerowitz, welcome.
Thank you.
Professional historians don't usually write about the recent past. Why did you think it was important to gather scholarly essays about September 11th?
In September of 2001, I was a professor of history at Indiana University, and I was also at that time the editor of the Journal of American History. After September 11th, I knew that I personally wanted historical perspective on the events of that day. And I also knew that I needed historical perspective in order to discuss those events with my students. And I wasn't alone. I heard from other scholars and teachers who were also looking for essays by experts that placed September 11th in historical context. So along with the editorial board and the staff of the journal, I planned a special issue of the journal on history and September 11th, which we eventually revised and published as a book. I think all of us who were involved in the project knew that the events of September 11th were momentous enough that we had to inquire about their roots, even if as historians we didn't have much hindsight and even if we couldn't assess the impact on the future.
You spoke of those events being momentous, and they certainly seemed that way at the time, so momentous that a lot of people claimed, one heard this a lot, that the future was going to be so much different from the past, everything had changed. It's almost as if history had ceased to matter.
I have to say I was somewhat surprised by some of the news reports in the days after September 11th. There was such a denial of history. Even the New York Times wrote that September 11th was one of those moments in which history splits. But all historians, I think, know that history doesn't just split in two or rupture into pieces. Even events that seem entirely new are always rooted in various ways in the past. We know, for example, that terrorism has a history, both as a practice and a concept. So does the U.S. war on terrorism. It's not brand new. And I could go on. The history of foreign policy helps us understand the emergence of anti-American sentiments. The history of religion helps us understand the emergence of fundamentalist movements and so on. In other words, even though it may have seemed that history no longer mattered, there are in fact lots of ways in which history was absolutely crucial.
In those days, especially the first days after 9/11, but continuing for a while too, a lot of Americans seemed to rally around the flag, and they were often in the media clear demarcations between good and evil, between them and us. Historians, by contrast, try to muddy the water, I think, dealing with ambiguity and messiness. On subjects like this, on 9/11, is there a kind of inherent conflict between what the public wants and what historians have to offer?
You know, I'm not sure that the public really does seek simple dichotomies, but even if it does, we have a duty as historians to remind ourselves and our students and the broader public about the complexity of the past. I think it's a good thing to question and complicate the stark them and us formulations and to replace them, if we can, with a history that pays respect to nuance and ambiguity and what you call messiness. We can also use history to understand patriotism and the desire to rally around the flag at a moment when we were attacked. So I'm not convinced there's a conflict between historians and the public, but if there is, we still need to tell complicated stories. It's what we do well.
What's the most important thing you'd like to have readers learn from your book, History and September 11th?
I guess I want readers to see that history does help us explain the events of September 11th, that we can't make sense of the present unless we study the past. I also hope that readers come away from the book questioning the simple them and us formulations. Readers will, of course, draw their own conclusions, as they should, about the meaning of September 11th. But I hope that their conclusions will be better informed by greater reflection on and greater knowledge of the past.
Well, Professor Meyerowitz, thanks for visiting with us today.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Joanne Meyerowitz, editor of History and September 11th. One of the contributors to the book is Melanie McAllister, a professor of American Studies and International Affairs at George Washington University. She is the author of the book Epic Encounters, Culture, Media, and U.S. Interests in the Middle East, 1945 to 2000. Her essay in History and September 11th is entitled A Cultural History of the War Without End. Professor McAllister, welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
In your essay, you raise the question of how to define terrorism. It's obviously a pejorative term, but what's not always clear is why one act of violence is condemned as terrorism while another, perhaps equally violent act, is not.
Yes, it's a really complicated question, and I want to say at the outset that I'm not a person who believes, as some people argue, that one man's terrorism is another man's freedom fighter. I mean, that's true, but I think we can and should make definitions and call some things terrorism. My concern is that we be consistent in that. One definition that I think makes sense is to talk about acts that aim at increasing fear or extracting a price from a civilian population. In that sense, for example, we absolutely would call the attacks on the Twin Towers in the United States on September 11th terrorism. We wouldn't call the war in Iraq terrorism. We might be opposed to it or concerned about it. It's violent for sure, but its aim is not to extract terror from a civilian population. At the same time, then, if we're going to be consistent in that, we wouldn't necessarily call attacks in Iraq on U.S. soldiers terrorism. They would be attacks on a military target with the aim of, military aim, essentially, of undoing the American occupation. We might consider them violent or bad, but that's not terrorism. So we can use a range of definitions, but we need to be consistent when we use them in order not to just say terrorism is the violence I don't like and everything else is the violence I approve of.
You use the word rupture in your essay. September 11th, you know, it was not a complete rupture with the past. Americans' awareness of terrorism goes back over 30 years to the hostage crisis visited on civilians at the 1972 Munich Olympics.
That's right. There obviously was terrorism before that, but the attack on the Munich Olympics in 1972 really riveted Americans. And that, if you recall, a group of Palestinian guerrilla fighters attacked and took hostage 11 members of the Israeli Olympic team. And when they did that, the Americans who were covering the Olympics were on site, so they actually captured the unfolding drama on television, and that's a central part of how Americans became so aware of it. Eventually, the Germans tried to get the Palestinians out and get them to release the hostages. Things fell apart. There was a battle, and all of the hostages and all the Palestinians were killed. So it ended up being a real disaster, and a disaster much of which unfolded live on television in the United States. So it galvanized a lot of Americans, and of course they felt, as they should, very sympathetic towards the Israeli civilians who were killed.
Now, those attacks weren't directed against Americans in 1972, but the United States had its own problems. It was still in Vietnam in 1972. Did that experience of the war have any effect on how Americans thought terrorism should be dealt with 30 years ago?
Absolutely it did, because the United States had already started paying close attention to Israel in 1967, during the 67 war between Israel and the Arab states, where Israel won in 6 days, the Six-Day War. At that point, the U.S. was mired in Vietnam, and a lot of people said, oh, we should look to the Israelis. They know how to have a quick victory, and here we are in a quagmire. Now, by 72, nobody in the United States thought there was going to be a quick victory in Vietnam, and when they responded to Munich, they responded very differently. They started saying, maybe it's time to negotiate. And in fact, Howard K. Smith, who was one of the announcers on ABC News, said specifically, the retreat from violence may be slow, but in the end, sheer weariness with the crisis that has long outlasted any national interest is going to prevail in the Middle East, as it will in Vietnam. So they immediately made the connection and said both sides need to negotiate, which was a different response than was had at other points towards what Israel was doing. But at that point, people thought we needed to negotiate to get out of Vietnam, and they began to say to the Israelis, maybe you need to negotiate to get out of this situation with the Palestinians.
Things changed dramatically 4 years later. In 1976, there occurred one of the most famous airplane hijackings in history, an event that culminated in the Israeli raid on Entebbe in Uganda. Remind us of what happened there.
Yes, it's really interesting in the 70s how quickly things change. And what happened at Entebbe was that a group of gunmen associated with the Palestinian, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. They actually weren't mostly Palestinians. They were West Germans and others, but they supported the Palestinian group. They hijacked a plane, and they forced it to fly to Uganda. Now, there they had one main demand, which was the release of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. But they also had another demand, which was to get public recognition of the Palestinian problem. You know, looking back, one could say it was just a terrible way to do that, but at that point, the Palestinians were relatively invisible. Eventually, the other non-Israeli citizens were released, and that opened up the possibility of an Israeli rescue. And the Israelis went in a very dramatic, very successful rescue. They killed all of the hijackers and got out 104 Israeli citizens. Now, this successful lightning strike in Uganda also was enormously influential in the United States. Henry Kissinger, Secretary of State, said he was very pleased. There was a detailed analysis in the U.S. press. There's a great cartoon that was syndicated of an Israeli Superman with a Star of David on his chest, carrying off two people, you know, saving them. So Israel was seen, in that case, as a model of tough, effective military power that could be used in a just war against terrorism. And also they were seen as victors, as a military power that won. And I think, again, in the wake of Vietnam, that had enormous influence. People, especially conservatives, really wanted to argue that Vietnam had been lost because the U.S. didn't unleash its full military might, and they looked to Israel as the proof for that.
As you put it rather nicely, rather succinctly, it becomes common after Entebbe for many in the United States to think they should not only act with Israel, but like Israel when it comes to things like this.
Exactly. And so there are hundreds of books that come out that analyze the Mossad and the Israeli military as kind of exciting models for Americans. But also, you know, you continue to see that even today with the war on terrorism. That is, a lot of people have talked about Israel as another nation that is fighting terrorism, and in that sense have seen it very positively as an ally. But also, after what we saw at Abu Ghraib with the violence and the torture of the prisoners there, some people also looked to what was going on in Israel, because there have been some of the same debates about interrogation techniques that the Israelis have used, dunking people, stress positions like that, which has been used by the Israelis for a while, but also very much debated by Israelis, some of whom are quite concerned about this use of harsh interrogation techniques against Palestinians. So that debate and the fact that the Israelis have been using those kind of techniques has shown that many people see a kind of connection between what the U.S. is doing and what Israel has been doing, both a positive connection and a negative connection.
The events that we've talked about so far in the 1970s, the Munich Olympics, the raid at Entebbe, didn't involve American prisoners or hostages directly. That changes in 1979, of course, with the taking of the hostages in Iran, who were held for over 400 days. There would seem to be very little in a 400-day hostage crisis that would be worthy of television, and yet it was blanket coverage. The Nightline started back in 1979, didn't it?
Nightline started out as a nightly show called America Held Hostage.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first time, a 30-minute show at 11 o'clock, and that went for about a year and a half, and then it changed to Nightline. So here is ABC every night doing a 30-minute special on the hostage crisis when, you know, at the beginning you have American cameras on scene and they're taking what at first are very dramatic pictures of the Iranians chanting outside the American embassy and burning American flags. But then after a while that kind of nightly ritual becomes very familiar and you don't see much else. The hostages are simply held and by and large they're not harmed. So what television does is to begin to focus on the families of the hostages. And this is really one of the first times that something that we're now very familiar with, the hostage family or the family of people who have been taken prisoner of war, becomes a kind of television icon. So people begin to interview the families. They go to the families' homes at Christmas. The hostage families as a group begin holding television conferences, news conferences. Of course, the September 11th families become a very similar kind of figure much later, right? And there's a history of that where Americans with the Iran hostage crisis begin to see the families as very much part of the story. Gary Sick, who was an official in the Carter administration, of course Carter was the president during that time, called the hostage story the longest running human interest drama in the history of television. So the story really got told in a soap opera-ish kind of way. I don't mean to denigrate anything the families were going through, because of course they were going through a great deal, but that was one of the things that allowed there to be television coverage every night. And then of course, just to mention, there was also the failed rescue attempt, right? There was an attempt to go in and rescue the hostages about 4 months after they were taken. That rescue attempt failed miserably. The helicopters broke up in the sand before the Delta Force was even able to get in. And that then became another comparison with Israel. The Israelis managed to rescue their people. We fail when we do it. The United States has to learn to build up its military in a different way. And I think that played a real role in Ronald Reagan's election in 1980.
Well, Reagan, when he's elected, sort of shifts the emphasis from what Carter had been doing. Carter talked about human rights. Reagan makes an emphasis on fighting terrorism. What exactly did he do, and was it very effective?
Well, that's a good question. Reagan, at his inaugural address, right, says that terrorism is going to be the major concern of his administration. And as a result, Reagan gets much more involved directly in the Middle East. There's the intervention in Lebanon in the early 1980s. There is, throughout the 1980s, a war between Iraq and Iran, which many people have heard about now. The United States supported Iraq during that war for the large part of it, and then later also supported Iran. So there was a back and forth supporting both sides, trying to make sure that neither one of them came out of the war too strong. The U.S. felt that Libya, I think with some good evidence, had been involved in a terrorist attack on a plane that went down in Lockerbie. And in response, the U.S. bombed Libya in the 1980s, increased support for Saudi Arabia. So a whole range of actions that got the United States more involved in the Middle East. Were they successful against terrorism? I think the record would have to be no. The United States gets attacked, the embassy gets attacked, and then the Marines get attacked in Lebanon. Hundreds of people die, and the U.S. has to pull out of Lebanon. Continuing attacks on civilians throughout the 1980s. So, no, these interventions weren't necessarily successful, but they put a tough new face on American foreign policy.
The emphasis of your essay, in fact, it's in the title, is a cultural history of this war on terrorism. And I can't help but notice here that in real life, it's not quite working out. The attempt to rescue the hostages in Iran fails dismally. The Marines are driven out of Lebanon. However, in the 80s, films are getting it right. We're winning on the silver screen.
Oh, it's just fascinating, actually, to see the ways in which certain kinds of actions are happening in the world, but movies are trying to rewrite that history even as it's happening. So during the 1980s, you see movie after movie that comes out, Navy SEALs, Delta Force, Iron Eagle, even the Die Hard series. You could even argue that the second Aliens movie is a hostage rescue movie. All these movies have as their plot people going in and saving hostages over and over and over again. When I started watching these movies for my book, I was really shocked at how much that was the story. You can imagine a lot of different stories about terrorism or about the United States being a great military power. This was the story. So what had failed in Iran becomes the obsession of American movies. And again, terrorism is defeated, the Americans are victorious, also the Americans are innocent, they're clearly the good guys. So there's a way in which the movies really function as a kind of wish fulfillment, as they have continued to do. But I think a lot of people came out of the 80s, in some sense, thinking that the United States had won a war against terrorism. It didn't really happen, but it happened at the movie.
Popcorn, a ticket, and defeating terrorism all at once. We conclude your essay by saying that after September 11th, our boundary of thought was forged in part by the narratives of the past, precisely the sort of things you've been talking about this morning, politically, culturally, and so on. And you continue that with the memory forgetting of captivity and rescue behind us, it would become time after 9/11 for Americans to win the 30 years war on terrorism by pretending it had just begun. Could you elaborate on that, please?
One of the things I wanted to argue is that after September 11th, the Bush administration announced that there would be a new war on terrorism. And he and other people in the administration acted as if this was something brand new for Americans and something that had really never been attempted before. In fact, this history from the 1970s and the 1980s was a very significant history for Americans to remember because it showed that there had been a debate in an earlier period. There had been concerns about Islam after the Iran hostage crisis, concerns about terrorism, and those had been debated, and there had been attempts to deal with them in a military fashion that had, in fact, largely failed. So even conservatives, after Reagan died, went back and some of them analyzed the ways in which the Reagan administration had failed to really accomplish its goals about terrorism. So if we remember that history, it might change the ways we debate the current situation. Of course, terrorism is a real problem, and there have to be some debates. But the debates can't happen at the level of wish fulfillment, like they happened in the 1980s. They need to happen with a strong historical consciousness so that, as they always say, we don't repeat the mistakes of the past.
Well, Professor McAllister, thanks so much for talking with us today.
It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I've been speaking with Melanie McAllister. Her essay, A Cultural History of the War Without End, is among the essays collected in Joanne Meyerowitz's History and September 11th.
To conclude this week's program on 9/11, for our Site of the Week segment, Talking History's Fiona Beatty tells us about an internet site which is one of the most exhaustive digital collections of 9/11 documents you're likely to find, with something to interest just about any virtual visitor.
The images and sounds of 9/11 are seared in our collective memory. In this, the information age, people across the world relied on their TVs to provide the latest news. But in the aftermath, many turned to the internet to provide additional news and reassurance. Web creators responded with a myriad of memorial sites, tribute pages, and survivor lists. Cyberspace became heavily trafficked as millions sought solace by emailing loved ones and using bulletin boards and chat rooms. Charities marshaled donations and blood drives, while the internet news services provided non-stop coverage. The historical record of internet activity is preserved online at the Internet Wayback Machine September the 11th Web Archive. The collection, and the process is still ongoing, was commissioned by the Library of Congress and contains thousands of sites, from CNN's coverage with the unforgettable headline, America Under Attack, to a small town's announcement of a welcome home party for a search and rescue team. To visit the site, go to web.archive.org/collections/sep11.html.
And that's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll join us next week for the second and concluding show marking the third anniversary of 9/11. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Fiona Beatty, producer. Alex Smith, our studio engineer. To learn more about Talking History, visit our website at oah.org. If you wish to send us your comments or suggestions, please do so by email to talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.